You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, November 19th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Mariah Blake on the fall of the House of Moon. Remember the Moonies? Well, they may be departing America soon, leaving with them a legacy that is truly, truly bizarre. Also on the program today, some good news in the States on the Obamacare exchanges. Also, Reverend Billy of the Church of Stop Shopping may be facing a year in jail for a 15-minute, literally, song and dance in a Chase Bank office. More reports out regarding the FISA court admonishing the NSA, and Walmart going to be prosecuted for violating workers' rights. All that and more on today's program. One bit of housekeeping. Ladies and gentlemen, on Wednesday of next week, 1 week from tomorrow, we will be having our, well, it's not annual, but we've done it in the past. My old friend Janine Garofalo will be joining us in studio to answer your questions on how to navigate the Thanksgiving holiday with your right-wing family. So if you are interested in having your specific question addressed, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Lay out the specific details of your family. Don't go crazy. I don't want to hear, you know, when they got off the boat and your grandparents and the blah, blah, blah. But give us some details and we will answer your question on Wednesday. So why don't you just put in the subject line pre-Thanksgiving. Pre-Thanksgiving, we will, of course, be talking to Janine about other things, but it should be a fun show. We will take your calls as well, as we are wont to do, but we will do it in the first part of the program. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Mariah Blake on the fall of the House of Moon.
Hit me like a tone.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Mariah Blake. She is a reporter for Mother Jones Magazine and a contributor to The New Republic. On her recent piece in The New Republic, The Fall of the House of Moon. Welcome to the program, Mariah.
Thank you for having me on.
So let's start with, I've been fascinated by Sung Young Moon, I think, since the story of his coronation that took place in the Dirksen Senate office building, I guess now 7 years ago or so. But let's take us back to this guy's beginnings. How did he start this empire?
How did he start his church, you mean?
Indeed. Well, I guess it depends on your perspective. I mean, but it's we're talking millions of dollars here, yes?
Yes, yes. I mean, it was an empire, yes. Absolutely. Well, I mean, he grew up on a farm in rural Korea. He was dirt poor. And he fled North Korea and built a mud hut on a hillside. And he started writing his teachings down on the walls and ceilings of this mud hovel. So it is definitely a up by the bootstraps operation. And, you know, as you mentioned, he built a multi-billion dollar business and political empire and managed to persuade tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people that he was the Messiah.
And so when was his heyday, as it were?
His heyday was, I think, the 1980s. There's a lot of different phases. His businesses may have been more successful later, but his political heyday was definitely in the 1980s. So the rise of the new right, he was closely connected with that. And he had very close connections to the Cold Warriors. One of his main causes was fighting communism. So he was able to make common cause with conservatives, some very influential conservatives, based on that issue.
Yeah, let's talk about that period of the rise of the new right. I mean, how would you describe the new right, and why was it so? I mean, how did he become so intertwined with them?
I mean, I think a lot of it had to do with money. So he very generously funded certain individuals and causes. He really helped fund the career of Richard Viguerie, who then his direct marketing strategies led to the rise of a lot of this, you know, this breed of politicians, people like Ronald Reagan. He was very generous and he gave a lot of money, for example, to proxy wars in Latin America, things of that nature that mattered to conservatives of this era.
I mean, talk about there's an interesting parallel, I think, on some level between Sung Young Moon and Reagan, in that the Sung Young Moon had this sort of notion of collectivism, I mean, things that we, you know, sort of a communal lifestyle, things that we almost relate to sort of the hippie culture on some level, but without the drugs. And in some ways, there's a parallel there with Reagan in terms of talking about optimism and sort of, I guess, this sort of idealism. I mean, just talk about how those sort of ideologies may have meshed or played off each other in some level.
You know, other than the shared values, particularly the fight against communism, I don't know. I mean, the thing is that Moon launched the Washington Times very early in Reagan's tenure, and it became a very influential voice that advanced Reagan's agenda. And I think that and Moon's largesse in other ways were the things that connected them. That and the anti-communist fervor, are the things that connected them rather than, you know, shared values on other fronts. You know, with the exception perhaps of the family values was obviously very important to Moon.
Right. And give us a sort of the broad sense of what the, I guess, the, I mean, the religious philosophy. I mean, some of the aspects of the Unification Church that people may have forgotten or may not be aware of.
Yeah, I think most people only know the mass weddings. So Moon believed that Jesus Christ was supposed to come to Earth and marry and create the perfect sin-free family. But he failed to do so, and so Reverend Moon himself had been sent to fulfill that mission. So he believed that he and his wife were the ideal couple, that they were going to give birth to this new sin-free bloodline, and that their followers could join that bloodline by marrying in one of his mass wedding ceremonies, and then eventually and going through a series of rituals. But there was also a world domination dimension. So he also believed that he was destined to take over the world, so that all that eventually this marital unity was akin to sort of all nations would eventually and religions would eventually come together under him, and he would be the king and messiah, and we would all live together in harmony on earth.
And hence the unification part of the Unification Church.
Yes, that is why it is called the Unification Church. Exactly.
And I mean, talk about the mass weddings, because I don't know, I certainly remember the images coming from Madison Square Garden, but I'm sitting in a room with a couple of under 30-year-olds who may not have any awareness of that. Just talk about that phenomenon, because it was a stunning phenomenon, and it's also sort of, it's so hard for me to get to wrap my hands around how this guy, who I think was basically a cult leader. I mean, I hope I'm not offending anybody by saying that, but I think that's the case. Ended up inserting himself into the corridors of power in such a dramatic fashion.
Yeah, it really is a study in persuasion. I think that's what drew me to this story. Here is this Korean guy who believes he's Jesus Christ. His religious teachings are peculiar by American standards, and yet he managed to really endear himself to large swaths of the political establishment, and he had quite a bit of political influence during his heyday.
I mean, talk about just tell us a little bit more about the mass weddings, because I'm not sure that people really fully grab the gist of the scope of these things.
These mass weddings, I mean, they would have thousands of couples marrying at the same time. I think the most famous ones in the United States were the ones in Madison Square Garden in the 1980s. But in the 90s, he actually had stadium weddings in Korea. So couples from all over the world would fly to Korea and get married there. And one of the really interesting things about these weddings, I mean, first of all, they were arranged by Moon. So oftentimes these couples had not met each other before they were married. And he believed that one of the ways he was going to unite the world is through intercultural and interracial marriage. So he would, for example, fly a woman over from Japan who spoke no English and marry her to an American man who she'd never met. And so a lot of these couples are, you know, a lot of these couples basically had no way of communicating when they first got together.
And I mean, has anybody followed up on like what happened to these couples?
Nobody. I there may be some academics who are studying this, although I think the interest has waned. I certainly met a lot of them in my reporting. And, you know, the outcome is very mixed. Some of them are still together and very devoted. A large number of them, you know, a large number of Moon's followers drifted away. And once they were no longer in the faith, there was less incentive to stay in their marriages, because their marriages were so closely intertwined with the religion. So when they lost their faith, oftentimes the families broke apart.
Interesting. And so, I mean, this idea of sort of interracial and inter, I guess, national marriage, how did that fit with his with Sung Yung Moon's Korean nationalism? Because in many respects, he functioned as, I don't know if an emissary, maybe you could talk about how he functioned relative between, as a liaison in some respects, it seems to me, between the United States and South Korea.
Yes, that's true. Well, he also had very close ties to the Korean Central Intelligence Agency, and one of his early front groups broadcast propaganda for the Korean Central Intelligence Agency. But he also, yes, he tried to serve as a cultural liaison for Korea. He believed Korea was the Adam nation, as he called it, so essentially a superior culture, and that all other nations, when they came together under him, would embrace Korean culture. And in his church, it's interesting because there is this intermingling of cultures, but the Koreans are always held above. So his own children, he did not marry them to people of other ethnicities. And the elites in the church for many years were all Korean. And while the non-Koreans were expected to sacrifice everything for the church, many of the Korean leaders actually got quite wealthy.
And where did the money come from? Was it members of the church? I mean, you reference in the piece Japanese donations.
Yes. So in Japan, where according to some early reporting, Moon's organization had very close ties with the mafia. Moon's followers persuade people that they can liberate their ancestors from hell by buying various kinds of trinkets, usually at extremely inflated prices. So most of the church's money comes from Japan. And there have been, I think, thousands of criminal investigations in Japan regarding its activities there. However, the church has also built a business empire here. So right now, half of all the sushi in the United States is produced by Moon family-owned enterprises.
Wow.
So many of the businesses that they started were, you know, hemorrhaged money. The Washington Times has burned through more than $3 billion. And those were subsidized by money from Japan. But other ventures were actually quite successful. So, and in, you know, they produce arms in Korea. They have a very, very varied business empire that, you know, some parts of it bring in quite a bit of money.
Well, and also the New York Hotel, which is actually right around the corner from us. I mean, so how did they, I mean, what, just give us a sense of just how much money the church has, and give us a sense of how they built this empire. I mean, it's massive.
In terms of how much money the church has, I don't think anybody has an accurate read on that. It's definitely in the billions. The family is fighting over one project in Korea, a half-built building on an island that the family owns, and that building alone is worth more than $1 billion. There's been, as I said, several billion put into the Washington Times. In terms of how they built it, a lot of it was, I mean, a lot of the early followers contributed labor, so that helped. But I think Moon and his deputy, Bo Hee Pak, were just very ambitious. And they took this ethos of world domination and applied it to business. So in the 70s, for example, they just started buying up large swaths of these fishing towns. And essentially taking them over, much to the dismay of locals. So I think it was just, you know, huge amounts of money and lots of ambition and free labor, that combination allowed them to build this empire very rapidly.
And when we say fishing towns, we're talking in the United States. I mean, I know I used to have some friends in Gloucester, in Gloucester, Massachusetts, and that was much of that town was owned by the church.
Yes, that is the place I think where the battle was most heated. So they bought much of the town, and then they bought the Catholic monastery. Locals burned moon in effigy, and they put bumper stickers on their car that said "Save the human race, punch a Mooney in the face." So it was, you know, these things were very, very controversial. There was this feeling that they were taking over, and I think that was the period of real rapid expansion. So the late 70s and 80s, and that town is probably the most emblematic of you know, their approach.
And so there's still this huge ownership stake, but it seems to be sort of much, much more quiet and perhaps more, I don't know, secular? Is that the right word?
Well, there's been a rift in the family, and there is a son, Preston, who basically controls most of the U.S. assets. And he is more secular. So I think that, you know, he changed the name of the corporation from Unification Church International to UCI. But also I think the church just doesn't have the influence that it had and is not as visible as it used to be. Moon was a charismatic figure, and I think as he retreated in his later years, the church lost a lot of its visibility.
And so do we have a sense of how many members of the church exist in the United States and in Korea and, I guess, worldwide?
The church has always inflated those numbers grossly, so it's hard to gauge. In the United States, all the sources I've spoken to estimate that it's less than 10,000, probably substantially less than 10,000 at this point. There was a time when it was in the tens of thousands, and they claimed to have 300,000 members. Globally, it is still quite vibrant in Korea and Japan, but it's difficult to get an accurate read on just how many members there are because, as I say, the church inflates the numbers.
And so essentially, in the United States, it's just basically a big holding company.
Yes. I mean, well, it's multiple holding companies now controlled by different siblings who are at war.
And this tracks with, I guess, the dissolution of the family. Just speak a little bit about it, because this story is just, it really is amazing. Obviously, you can't go through it in the same detail that you do in the piece, but just give us some of the high or low lights, I guess.
Well, yeah, Moon began dividing his empire among his children really in the early aughts. And there was initially three of his children warred with, disputed, I guess, yeah, they there was a conflict over the church itself. So the religious entity, which also owns a lot of the business enterprises, and it ended up being taken over by Moon's daughter, Injin, who remade it as a rock and roll megachurch, essentially. And then disappeared from view, and it turned out that she had an illegitimate child by the lead singer of this rock band she put together called Sonic Cult. And given the emphasis on family values in the church, this was devastating. But it went on from there. I mean, essentially, after that, Moon's wife ended up ousting all of her children who had been given leadership roles by her husband, and she is now in control of essentially everything except for the properties that are under control of Preston, who is the son who split with the church in the aughts. So,
and she has redirected her energies away from the United States from a sort of proselytizing perspective.
She has have never had, Moon was always fascinated with the United States. He had a love affair with this country. She has never seemed to share that enthusiasm. And now that she's in charge of the church, she really seems to be focusing her energies elsewhere. She really spends all of her time in Korea. So she's not very involved with what's happening in the United States.
And so, I mean, give us a sense of Moon's impact in terms of our, I mean, you mentioned that he was aligned in some respects with the South Korean intelligence agency, the South Korean intelligence agency. Was there a sort of a marked, did he have some type of marked influence on our relationship with South Korea? How would it have been different were it not for Moon?
It's hard to know just how much influence he had. He had a campaign in the 70s where he actually encouraged young, attractive female followers to infiltrate the offices of senators and was pretty successful. And they, you know, once they were inside these offices, they would lobby and collect intelligence. He had relationships with a lot of influential people in Washington. So one would presume that he had some influence. He certainly had influence in Latin America, and was actually involved in fomenting a coup in Bolivia, funneled a lot of money to the Contras. So he has definitely had an effect on geopolitics, and he has certainly had an effect on politics in the United States. I can't speak directly to his impact on U.S.-Korea relations.
When you say he infiltrated or he sent young women to infiltrate the lawmakers' offices, were they aware that they were that these were people who were being placed by Reverend Moon, or were they completely unsuspecting? And I'm just trying to get a sense of like, was this just a story of a guy who had a lot of money and he would make requests of lawmakers, and then some percentage of the time lawmakers would be like, oh God, we really stepped in it by saying yes to this.
It's hard to know how much they actually knew. I mean, at the time there was quite a bit of reporting done about the fact that these women were working in these offices. I think they were essentially volunteering their time, and they were pleasant and charming, and for whatever reason, these lawmakers accepted them into their offices. I mean, certainly the broader question, why Moon was allowed to have as much access as he did on so many fronts is a very interesting question. I mean, I think it says quite a bit about our politics.
Yeah, I wonder. I mean, like, you mentioned that John Gornfeld, who I think he had written a book, and I believe.
Yeah, he wrote a book called Bad Moon Rising.
Yeah, and we had interviewed him at the time, and I think that's where the story of the coronation broke. I mean, do we know anything about sort of those lawmakers, their response to it? Is anybody ever sort of said, boy, yeah, that was something I really felt uncomfortable once we got there and we realized he was literally going to have a coronation?
Well, a lot of them did say that. There was an article in the New York Times that ran shortly after the coronation ceremony, and many of them tried to distance themselves from the coronation, including people who were sponsors of the event. But other people, including, I believe, Danny Davis, who carried out the crown that was put on Mrs. Moon's head, sort of seemed to think it was okay, or didn't, at least didn't make an effort to explicitly distance themselves from the coronation.
Yeah, I think when you're when you're the crown carrier, you have a tough time with plausible deniability, right? I mean,
I suppose that's true, yes.
And you end your piece where the Sun Myung-moon's wife, widow, I guess, is speaking to 15,000 people in a a Mooney-owned arena, and Denny Hastert is there?
Yes.
Yeah, just expand on that. I mean, this is just sort of bizarre to me. Like, what's bizarre to me is both the relationships and the fact, I mean, obviously Denny Hastert's out of politics now, but these relationships and how none of it seemed to stick or be problematic for their constituents.
Yeah, here's another example that's less well known. In 1993, Senator Trent Lott stood on the floor of the Senate and urged lawmakers to celebrate True Parents Day, which is the holiday when Unificationists honor Reverend Moon and his wife. The following evening, 200 people showed up at the Dirksen, at a room in the Dirksen Senate office building for a True Parents Day celebration. So something, a lavish celebration where Moon was celebrated as the king and Messiah. The following year in 1994, the Republican-controlled Congress passed a bill designating Parents Day a national holiday, and they used the exact same text that Trent Lott read in his 1993 speech, urging lawmakers to honor True Parents Day. So essentially, True Parents Day, this holiday honoring Reverend and Mrs. Moon, was made a national holiday by Congress.
Wait, I mean, what is it? This is just like, you know, I keep coming back to this. I have such a hard time sort of wrapping my arms around this. Is it simply that the guy had just so much cash and, you know, through the Washington Times was providing a lot of sort of cover for right wing policies? He's funding the Contras. He is, you know, holding the line against the North Koreans, maybe. I mean, from his perspective, but is it because it's also a religion that, or it was perceived as a religion that, I mean, how does a cult leader get this type of play? And the politicians that are literally carrying the water or the crown for him don't get caught up in the implications of it?
It's a very good question. To the first part about how he got this power, I think that you're correct. I mean, it's a combination of political largesse. So he gave lots of money, and campaign cash speaks loudly. I mean, he also gave money to front groups. He was really very, you know, he had a network of very influential front groups, who had the power to move public opinion. And he also, you know, gave generously to politicians, and he had this media organ, which was very influential. So if you are a politician who is, you know, has to get elected every 4 years, this is a good person to have on your side. I don't know that his status as a religious leader helped him gain influence, because his religion was so controversial. And occasionally, you know, I mean, oftentimes religious conservatives or politicians it was an offshoot of Christianity in the way there were points of commonality between his religious ideas and those of religious conservatives in the United States, so such as the focus on family. But if you dug very deeply into it, his ideas, even on those fronts, would be viewed as heretical by most mainstream or evangelical U.S. Christians.
Yeah, that's the part that I don't understand, is that, I mean, I guess nobody just, there was no apparatus in which to dig into him. I mean, you know what I mean? There was just no one to sort of send the message, I guess, to the evangelical base of the Republican Party that, hey, this guy who is, you know, you've got this guy is sort of, his belief system is fairly antithetical to yours. The guy who would ultimately be the leader of the Republicans in the Senate is proposing a national holiday to anoint these two, the sort of like the, I guess not the Adam and Eve, but the father and mother of all humanity.
Yeah. It is quite something. I do think, again, money is part of the answer, because he also gave quite a bit of money to religious conservative organizations. And he bailed some of the lions and stalwarts of the movement out in times of financial crisis. And those people had his back.
It's fascinating. And I guess it's, largely, I guess this guy's chapter in sort of political influence in this country is over. And I'm not obviously his, but I mean, the church, but I guess its power simply lives on now as just a corporation.
Well, the Washington Times still exists. It still has some influence. There's many of the influential conservative pundits out there churned through its pages. And I think that Moon's values and ideas continue to inform the conversation, even if he isn't active. It's hard to gauge just how much, but I do think that, you know, that he continues to have some influence.
Well, it's really an amazing story, and I appreciate you coming on and talking to us about it. Do we know if Sonic Cult's going to be releasing a new album soon?
I don't know. They have a website. You can check it out.
we'll
can also see videos and photos, although I noticed they've culled the photos somewhat since the story came out.
Well, we will check it out. Mariah Blake, the piece is The Fall of the House of Moon. We'll link to it on our site at majority.fm. It's in the New Republic. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me on.
All right, folks. We're going to head into the funner half in just a moment. We should say that I think we mentioned this yesterday in the program. David Pakman is going to do some type of simulcast with us in the better half of the program, wherein I think he's going to interview me. In fact, I'm not really sure what we're doing. Let me get to this story. And there's two things that are interesting about this. One is we, on the day that the Washington Post, or I should say the day after the Washington Post, writes an editorial suggesting that the idea of expanding Social Security is just horrific because of what it does to wealthy people. The idea of someone making $200,000 a year having to pay an extra $4,000 in taxes. That's almost an extra, almost $350 a month in taxes over the course of the year out of, I guess, presumably something like $18,000 a year, I guess it would be, $18,000 a month in take-home pay. It really does make you think. I guess it was a millionaire having to pay an extra $50,000 a year in taxes. But the day after that happens, Elizabeth Warren announces that she not only was condemning the chain CPI, but she also called for an expansion of Social Security payments. And what's interesting here is simply the amount of attention that her call for this is getting. This has obviously been a bill that has been around for some time. Tom Harkin has a proposal to do so. We know that Sherrod Brown has come out in favor of this, obviously Bernie Sanders. But it just goes to show the voice that Elizabeth Warren has now in our political ecosystem. I mean, remember, we're talking about, while she is the senior senator from Massachusetts, we're talking about still a freshman. It's just impressive. I just wanted to note it because this is a proposal that is gaining traction. And I mentioned this on the in the second half of the program yesterday, but it's also time for someone to come out. One of these political leaders come out with, as there is a tremendous amount of panic about the Affordable Care Act website and whatnot, and the idea of cancellations, which I should note, I think is completely overblown and will, in fact, I believe, blow over in time. Maybe 3 months, maybe 6 months, but it will blow over as things begin to settle and people begin to realize exactly what's involved here. But this is a perfect opportunity to say, even if it is maybe impractical in terms of execution, but to start offering fixes from the left. The easiest fix, as far as I can tell, at least from a rhetorical stance, is if the federal government has caused people to have their policies canceled, which, frankly, I think is also largely untrue. We know that the percentage of people who maintain a insurance policy in the non-group or in the individual market is somewhere around 17%. Not all of those even were non-compliant policies. So the percentage is rather small. But if we're going to that stipulated, if we're going to have this huge outcry, then there should be a response. And the response should be that the federal government will offer anyone whose policy on the individual market has been canceled and they don't like the option that exists in the private marketplace, that they can buy in to Medicare, calling it Medicare E for everyone who had their policy canceled. Or everyone who wants to enroll in Medicare. So it's just an interesting dynamic. We talked a little bit about it on the program yesterday, but I wanted to mention it in the freebie half. Tomorrow on the program, we will have Diane Ravitch. She is the former Bush education, not secretary. Was she full secretary or? Advisor, and she's someone we've wanted to have on the program for a long time, so make sure you tune in tomorrow. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we will be talking to David Pakman. We'll be right back after this. Oh, and don't forget, you can become a member at majority.fm. You can also support this program by buying your Amazon junk through our Amazon link found at the homepage. Click it. Bookmark it, buy your crap through there. You will see no difference. But we will have a big spring in our step. JustCoffee.coop, Fair Trade Coffee, Tea, or Chocolate. We'll be right back after this.